Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine here at WFERLP, South Royalton, Vermont. It's time for your weekly environmental news magazine coming up on our 13th anniversary of the radio station in a couple of weeks and also of this program. My colleague Henry Swayze is online. He'll be joining us shortly. Right off the bat, though, before I play a little music that's based on a story, we will check in an updated story and maybe even the concluding part of a long-running tale. Trail Tale. Green Zine is brought to you today by Soliflect, also Bale, Building a Local Economy. Check out their activities at balevt.org. Tom Wells, longtime supporter, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. All right, let's go to this. Don Williams, I have played the Steve Gillette, Cindy Manxon version of this song. They're residents of Vermont down in Bennington. But here's Don Williams with The Old Trail, and then we'll let you know why we're playing this great song.
There's a new ridge road that cuts the mountain to the bone, slices through the woods like there ain't nobody home. You can wheel on up to Valley View, you'll never feel the climb. Oh, but I take the old trail every time. The old trail just moseys right along, moves at the speed of a sweet love song. And the wind through the trees carries her own wind chimes. Yeah, I take the old trail every time. Lately it seems things vanish by degrees. How soon we forget we made our tree houses out of trees. When we gonna realize some reasons just don't rhyme? Yeah, I take the old trail every time. The old trail, now may she never fade, the one where the deer always have the right of way. How I love watch the wintergreen along the timber line. Yeah, I take the old trail every time.
Well, I'm going to bring that down, that line about the deer have them right away. Wow, that brought a tear to my eye. Just before I bring Henry on, a headline in today's Herald and also in yesterday's Valley News. I wouldn't be surprised if Vermont Digger also picks up on this story. So from the front page of our paper, our weekly paper of record here in the Upper White River watershed, Tunbridge has right to maintain trails. Supreme Court upholds lower court ruling on legal trails. Story written by a guy that's been following this legal imbroglio since the very early stages, the journalist from the Herald, Darren Marcy. I'm just going to go to a section here towards the end of the story. Here, the plaintiffs in this case, we'll just call them the plaintiffs, argued in front of the Supreme Court a couple of times about the status of the town's maintenance and say-so over legal trails, that a 1986 update to the statute removed trails from the definition of highways, eliminating the right for towns to maintain the trails. In their arguments before the High Court, the landowners argued towns lack the authority on private property because there is no explicit grant of authority as there is on roads. Supreme Court begged to differ, however, citing the law's use of the term public right-of-way in the definition of trail, which under the law is a type of easement. The court wrote that a public right-of-way provides the right of passage to the public in general, such as on roads, freeways, and other thoroughfares. Quote, therefore, under the common law, towns can repair and maintain those trails to the extent necessary to ensure those issues, the opinion reads. The court also wrote that statutes allow towns to regulate how trails are used and exempts towns from liability related to maintenance and repair. Once again, quoting the court, it would not make sense for the town to be able to regulate the use of trails but not have the power to conduct the maintenance and repair required to support those uses. If towns were precluded from maintaining or repairing trails, there would be no purpose in releasing towns from liability for failure to do so. Henry, are you out there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Did you hear all that? That was just part of the story.
I heard that. Congratulations to all the people who worked on this and the extensive court activity required to actually have a sensible conclusion to this.
a sensible, pretty obvious conclusion that could have been reached or at least approached about 5 years ago. So it's been a long time coming. We've been out actually on that trail, the disputed trail. I think what folks need to realize, not only within our listening area, is that a lot of towns in Vermont, more than half of the towns in Vermont, have legal trails which are used by outdoor environmentalists, recreationalists, hunters, people on bikes, people on skis, people hiking, people who have those kind of high-tech strollers taking their kids out on these trails where maybe they don't have access to that type of beauty of nature where they live, that a adverse ruling on this legal trail issue would have resulted in a real mess throughout the entire state of Vermont. But we've avoided it.
Right. And this is the first lawsuit that's ever been brought. So it's never gone through the court system before, has it?
Not on this specific issue. And the plaintiff is a pretty well-known property lawyer professor. So there were certainly, we could go on about the expertise or lack thereof from many angles. But no, I don't think this has ever been challenged. The things that stuck out to me in the opinion were common law and public right-of-way. And I did attend an earlier Supreme Court hearing, Vermont Supreme Court hearing on this issue, and neither attorney, both for the plaintiff or for the town of Tunbridge, the defendant at the time, used the term right-of-way, public right-of-way, in front of the state Supreme Court, which, as you can see from the opinion, was the key factor in this decision.
Right, right.
So anyway.
Sounds like it all makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
Going back to the adage, the wheels of justice turn slow, but grind very finely.
Yeah, I think I might have paraphrased that a little bit in the letter to the editor. We're definitely on the same page, Henry, and that's why we do this show together. You're on Green Zine, Henry Swayze with me. Hey, before we get into Bird Note, Henry, who are we going to be visiting with?
So Linda Gray is going to join us, and she is on the Norwich Energy Committee, and I thought she needed to, she could share with us. She went to the legislature as a volunteer and offered input on funding, gathering her own data for greenhouse gas emissions. The Trump administration has successfully stopped gathering any information about greenhouse gas emissions. So we used to get some of our state figures from the EPA, and they do not appear to be available anymore.
Hey, remind me, Henry, were some of that data, were they being collected by government-owned satellites? Am I recalling that?
That's methane.
That's the methane, okay.
And that's not just government-owned. Those are privately owned, actually.
Okay, so we still might be getting methane
right,
reports.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably greenhouse gas emissions, CO2, might have been measured by government satellites. But I'm not sure the satellites, they're just not spending any money. They're turning off anything that the government has to spend money on so they can turn that into tax breaks.
Okay.
That's really the bottom line.
It does seem that way.
and they also don't want, they want oil and gas to be maximized in use. And if you have information about how bad that is for the environment, then that encourages people to do something sensible instead of contributing to global warming and health effects from it and all that. And
mm-hmm.
All that. I guess while I'm on the same subject, the big beautiful bill that went through, that was an attempt in that to take out the Energy Star ratings for appliances. And the Republicans and industry was so incensed because those are actually pretty good sales tools for manufacturers of plug-in appliances.
Hmm.
So the Energy Star ratings are considered valuable on other fronts other than the environmental ones. And the Republicans didn't allow that to get gutted. They actually increased the funding for it. But the EPA had most of its workforce culled. And so even though they have the money to do it, they're not getting to new appliances very fast. But the website has not been taken down, and Energy Star is still appear in the marketplace. So that was one that even the Republicans couldn't stomach taking down.
If it's bad for business, no, I don't think they would agree with that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm looking at a turkey vulture here, Henry. The turkey vulture did finally fly into the studio after a couple of tries. Should we go to a little story about migration?
This is the turkey vulture is just the leader of the flock.
The leader of the flock sounds like a rock band. Hey, here we go, a flock of seagulls, but we have a turkey vulture here. Bird note on Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio. Except that it won't play. Hang on, I'm looking down below. Yeah, it's saying, listen now. I don't know, we're having a problem with Green Zine. We may have to skip that, Henry. Even though it's right in front of me, it's not playing. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still
there. No, wait. It's the computer showing up late. I think we have it now.
This is Bird Note. Birds breathe life into spring. Before we see or feel the season, we often hear it first. In the testimony of a red-winged blackbird, the energy of a song sparrow, or the serenade of an American robin. But across much of the continent, an earlier sign of spring is a naked, ruddy head gliding north on big wings. Turkey vultures often precede the parade of migrants, like an advance team exploring the terrain. When it comes to migration, the turkey vulture gets a head start on other species. Its winter range reaches fairly far north, especially along the coasts. During warm spells in winter, a few daring vultures might even drift as far north as Vermont or Oregon. But the first genuine migrants show up across the U.S. as early as February or March. Unlike most of our returning birds, which migrate at night, turkey vultures migrate like hawks in the daytime. They rise on warm spring updrafts with a distinctive teeter from side to side, and then they glide northbound. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
All right, there's your weekly dose of Bird Note.
Yes, indeed. They've been doing that for 12 years now. So it gives you pretty big choices if you can. There's some areas I tried to get the a listing of the first first birds to start singing, start courtship, I saw what I think were two crows flying together and doing little courting maneuvers in the air. I was attempting to get a bird note on that subject, but the best I could come up with is the parade of birds that we hear in the spring, which is pretty great. And we certainly, on warmer days, I'm hearing some courtship song here in Burlington. So, I have another piece that is interesting. There's a recent issue of Volts, I think yesterday's or the day before's, that points out that that Balcony Solar, which has been passed in Utah, and we had last time we reported on it, I think there were about 7 states that were considering legislation on it, and we're now up to 24 states that are considering legislation on it.
Yeah.
And a funny story in Canary Media about it that said that in some legislatures, there were more than one people that brought bills to the floor for it because they didn't know the other person was doing it. And that's the kind of enthusiasm for getting onto it, and especially in states where the where their electric bills are climbing really rapidly. Right. Ours are high to start with, but places where people's bills are going up 20%, 30%, 40%, they say, "Oh my goodness, what do I do about this?" And that has triggered a lot of legislative action. So as I've said before, the plus side of this is that you can trim a little bit off your electric bill, pay for $20-$30 worth of electric bill every month just by hanging some solar panels out. Probably in Vermont, you're with the current price structure for the equipment, we're likely to get less than a 5-year payback, maybe even as little as a 3-year payback on doing it, and then it's free electricity after that. But one of the issues raised in that Volts podcast is, so how much of this is going to just trigger people's appetite for expanding this and doing more and more with solar? And will it wear down? I mean, it's been allowed. All of this says this is power going, reducing your electric bill, and some of it probably going back to the grid without the without going through all the permitting process, and it's taken it out of the control of the utility companies. And they're not pushing back against this because they don't think it isn't enough power to make a noticeable problem for them.
Not at the moment.
But the legislation proposed in Vermont is for 1,200 watts.
Right.
So it isn't a typical household is probably drawing at least 700 of that watts pretty much all the time. Although in my house, it certainly if I have all the lights turned off during the daytime when the sun's shining, I got a refrigerator and a water pump and a few fans that run all the time, but they're small fans. I doubt I probably would use up the 1,200 watts. I'd be, but it's they are set up so that the linemen cannot get shocks off the line when the utility company power goes down. There is the solar the conversion from the DC from the solar panels to AC is immediately turned off. So unless you have batteries, this does not supply power to you when the grid is down. It turns off its electrical activity, so to protect the people who might have to be repairing the lines.
You were showing me the other day some of the workings that you've put together for this sort of shutoff valve, and like you were telling me.
Well, so this is an automatic built-in thing to the equipment. So I put up about a little over 3,000 watts. Mm-hmm. So three, four times what someone
would be allowed.
Balcony
yeah.
solar might be allowed.
Right.
And I didn't want to be making waves for the electric company. Washington Electric, which is I'm on, I believe in Tunbridge, can accept power. They'll allow net metering and accept power back on the grid. But they have areas in their territory that do not have the ability to accept any power back on the grid. The substations are not set up to handle anything coming back from the grid, and so it really causes them troubles in one of those areas. And I think they're just one or two towns. It's a very small area within their territory that's like that. But it can be a problem for a utility company. So, So what I had done was I set it up so that I am. When I'm generating electricity with my solar panels, it's either going to my batteries or it's going to the house, and I've turned off my connection to the utility company. So I have a switch that allows me to switch between utility power and my own power. So I charged my EV. I just got that finally set up the rest of the way, and I was in Tunbridge the day before yesterday, at the tail end of the day when I had that all ready to go, and I plugged my EV in, and I got about an hour and a half worth of charging from the batteries.
Mm.
Excuse me, from the solar panels.
Oh, directly.
And then
okay.
Direct from the solar panels.
Wow.
But it wasn't enough to, I had not charged fully when I left Burlington. So I didn't really have enough power to get back to Burlington. And so I switched back to grid power on the overcast day the next, yesterday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I used the grid power to add another 30 miles onto my range to have a comfortable return to Burlington. So if I'd been there for a few more days, I would have been able to get it all from my solar panel. I don't spend enough time at home and anyone time to necessarily have any sunlight.
Well, we're moving towards the sunnier months as spring is not that far away. Henry, we're a little bit over, and I think it's time for you to round up our guest here, and I will bring you back on in just a few minutes. It is about 24 minutes past the hour of 11 o'clock if you're listening in live time. I'm going to bring up the old trail here underneath again, the Don Williams piece. And there's another solar story, but I will wait on that. Letting you know about an environmental-related story and opportunity coming up this weekend at the Tunbridge Public Library as part of their conservation series on Sunday afternoons. Vermont moose is the topic this Sunday with wildlife biologist Josh Bluen giving an inside look at Vermont's moose at the upcoming Sunday series. It gets underway Sunday, March 1st at 2 p.m. at the Tunbridge Public Library. Bluen manages wildlife management areas, reviews development projects for impacts on wildlife and their habitats, and supports both bear and moose research for the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. With a bachelor's in wildlife biology from UVM, Bluen went out west to study black and brown bears, wolverine, hope he was being careful with them, Canada lynx, and other species. He returned to Vermont back in 2017 to work on the state's first moose research project and completed his UVM master's degree on moose habitat use and the impacts of winter ticks. And if you want to look down the road a little bit, the next Sunday series for the Sunday series on March 15th will be about preserving Vermont's covered bridges, and it'll be presented by the Vermont Covered Bridge Society. So something to do on this coming Sunday. Henry, are you back with us now?
I am, and Linda Gray, welcome to Green Zine.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, good morning, Linda.
Great.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I was telling listeners that it's amazing what the volunteers from the energy committees all around the state do, and you're just another very bright example of that, having gone to the legislature to argue for the state actually measuring what's happening to its greenhouse gases. And I've put in the show notes that if you can't measure it, you can't do anything about it. There's no legislation. There's no teeth. So,
right. Yeah, that's one of the key arguments for this. So last week, I was invited to join, and I think it was like at least a dozen or so folks from a variety of energy committees across the state for a little lobby day. And so we, among the group, folks that testified with the House Energy and Digital Infrastructure at House Environment Committee, also I think it was, I forget whether it was Senate or House Transportation, we were able to meet with the President Pro Tem of the Senate and also with the Speaker, and also Senate Natural Resources. So anyway, it was a very good day, and one of the things that we talked about was this bill that would follow up on a recommendation from the Climate Council and the latest, the 2025 Climate Action Plan, for a greenhouse gas emissions reporting and inventory. And so that seems to be moving along, and so that's what you referenced, Henry, about, you know, needing to measure stuff. So this would cover the types and value of fuel sold for transportation in residential, commercial, and industrial use. So so let me just stop there and find out what details you want to hear about.
Yeah, so I guess, am I correct? The research I did indicates that the EPA is no longer producing emissions reports, and that the state used to use those, and so this is an attempt to codify the information that in some ways is already being gathered in the state, but isn't in a very usable form for the legislature. Am I right about that?
Well, I don't know for sure about the EPA connection, but what I can say is from looking at there's a memo from the Agency of Natural Resources, you know, in support of this request, because they're following up on the climate action plan. And so one of the things, as they mentioned, is they to do this, because the climate action plan recommendation is develop a framework for the reporting of greenhouse gas emissions data from fuel suppliers and other significant emitters of climate pollution. So the ANR was looking at that and saying, like, well, they could take the approach, they call it harmonization, where that's trying to take, trying to pull together and get the answers from some data that is already being collected. For example, they were saying, like, it could be fuel sales data collected by tax department and motor vehicles and stuff. They are instead aiming for doing a standalone reporting focused on this, and so that's what I know about it. They are suggesting the budgetary number that I was hearing last week for doing this would be about $500,000, and so basically the bill to proceed and approve setting up this reporting framework is coming out of the House Committee on Energy. They call it a letter of support or something, but with regard to the funding letter would come out of the House Environment Committee. And so last week they were talking about doing that to the level of $500,000.
Do you have any feedback on whether they thought this much money could be wrenched free from the tight budget that we're operating in, and what the likelihood of that happening is?
I kind of got the impression that we talked to one rep from House Environment that was going to be in charge of drafting this funding letter, and so. And she was a Democrat, and she would be working with a Republican on the committee. It seemed like she was, you know, ready to move forward. And so I don't know for sure till I guess they have the vote on it. But it seemed likely. So I hope so. And we, from the Energy Committee end, we were definitely encouraging the two committees to proceed with their responsibilities on this, because one, you know, it was highlighted among the recommendations for action from the Climate Action Plan. So I definitely expect, you know, as a constituent, I would expect the legislature to follow through on that. And then separately as well, we were highlighting how at the local level, when you're trying to do planning, particularly like the enhanced energy planning stuff, lots of the data that we get from our regional planning commissions, particularly in this area, it's all extrapolated data. And so we'd end up, I know when we in Norwich went through this in 2017, we looked at that data and we just felt like, oh, this really doesn't make any sense to us. Where does this come from? And the reason is that it isn't actual data based on anything going on in our town. It is extrapolated from broad surveys and stuff. So I think that, again, back to the, you know, you can't manage what you can't measure. I think there's lots and lots of good reasons to do this. And I'm hopeful, and I don't think it's misplaced hope, that I'm hopeful that the legislature will follow through.
Do you think that will actually be broken out by towns or by counties, something more specific than the EPA numbers, which were for the whole state?
I hope that it will be more than just statewide data. I hope and think based on you know what they would do is that it would at least be kind of regional level. I definitely think that it will be more specific and more useful to us than what we have to work with now.
I have to say
I don't know for sure.
I have a question, but
on how they set it up.
But I agree with you, Linda, as far as bringing it at least down to the regional planning commission level. And we here are in the same, I believe, you are with Two Rivers. Isn't Norwich part of the Two Rivers?
Most
of our listening towns are in that district. And I believe statewide there might be 9, seems to ring a bell, as far as the number of regional planning commissions. And, of course, a lot of us have had dealings with Kevin Geiger, et cetera, that would probably be a little bit more workable way of collecting this data. And particularly since those are paid folks that are supposed to be helping the small towns. Here you're going up to the legislature. I don't think you get paid to be on the Norwich Energy Committee.
None of us do, right.
And so, you use some of your free time, and your colleagues who visited up there and serve on a lot of these energy committees put in their own time because they care about the future of the planet and their towns and their regions. So I'm hoping that that's at least gets down to that level. It might not get as granular as per town. So do you have the House bill number? I was at a recent Democratic, Orange County Democratic gathering, and Larry Sackwitz, I believe, serves on the House Environment Committee. Is there a House bill number that's attached to this? And do you feel like it's going to make crossover? It sounds you're pretty optimistic that it's going to make it through the crossover. Could you give us?
So. So that the bill number is H740.
Okay, 740. Got
740.
It.
Yep. And and so the chair of the House Energy Committee, Kath James, is the sponsor of this. So I think so. I mean, we were highlighting it. I know the different advocates on energy and environmental issues in, based in Montpelier, are all prioritizing this. So I expect it to move forward. I definitely expect it to move forward, and hopefully with the funding. And so there are many, many steps with all of this, but, I think there are folks keeping their eye on all of it, so I hope it's going to make it through.
Mm-hmm.
So remind us, Linda, how the state is doing on meeting its goal of 100% renewables by 2030.
I think we like pretty much everything you look at and is that we are not meeting our climate goals.
No.
I read this about many other states as well, but anyway, that's quite disappointing in that, like, we need to keep pushing, and we need to keep people paying attention to it and realizing that. And so one of the things, if I may take a moment, one of the things in the remarks I gave at the committees that I testified in there, and it sounds like you guys are perhaps you're perhaps fan of Dave Roberts' podcast.
Yes.
Well, so I was very taken a few months ago. He interviewed a fellow named King Smilbond, who used to be at Rocky Mountain Institute, is now with an analysis group called Ember, and they had put out a report, I think, last fall. But one of the key things from the conversation with this fellow, and he's a financial analyst, 30 years experience, but was that about the physics that are all in favor of what he calls clean tech, meaning solar and wind as the source of electricity, and then various electrical appliances and devices that are using that electricity, and that the physics of it is so important to understand, which is that there are so many losses when you are burning things up. I was quoting him saying, like, a natural gas plant is perhaps 40, maybe 50% losses, and then gas cars, it's 70 to 80% losses. And in contrast, clean tech is perhaps 10% energy loss. And so that's one of the basic reasons why it makes so much sense for us to make this transition, and we just have to keep pushing at it regardless. I think for the most part, there are political obstacles that are put in the way, and obstacles from companies that don't want they're making money off fossil fuels, and they don't want to stop making money, and so that's why they don't want to see this transition.
Yeah. It's an evil world, that money brings. Although it's pretty useful stuff when you have it.
Hey, I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit to a subject that we're going to cover a little more thoroughly next week. But several towns around Vermont, and this is about electricity usage, and still here in Vermont, where some of our power supply does come from fossil fuels. So with data centers springing up in other states in massive ways, like down in Virginia, I saw a picture of the size of one of them, and amazing amounts of energy and water being used. Do you get a sense from the people that accompanied you to the state house as far as and the towns that are actually having non-binding referendums about a moratorium? There's a bill actually in the legislature, a moratorium on data centers. Is that something that your committee and other energy committees should be looking at, sort of in tandem with cutting back on fossil fuels, obviously, but also not adding more electricity burden to the state?
Right, and I've been hearing, I would characterize it as just kind of the beginnings of discussion about it, mm-hmm. because I think kind of in a general sense, I think we all feel like, oh, well, we haven't heard of any proposals. But I was just listening, perhaps you guys are aware of another podcast, it's called Democracy Dispatch, that Vermont Conservation Voters does. And I think it was this week's was a conversation with Senator Becca White, who's from Windsor County, and then also Representative Laura Sebelia. And each of them have introduced something that relates to data centers. I think it's Senator White's is the moratorium, like don't have any, and Representative Sebelia's is to begin a process to set up. It's like, okay, what's a framework? If they come, what's our framework of rules and regulations for them in terms of, water and electricity and a variety of different parameters? And so I think, yeah, people definitely are thinking ahead about that. I believe from that podcast, I believe I heard the two legislators indicating that Greenmount Power has not had a serious inquiry from a company that wants to locate something in Vermont, but I would maybe characterize them as hypothetical questions about if somebody were to come to us, where, could something be placed? So I think at this point there's no proposals, but I think people are becoming aware of the need to think ahead on the issue.
Right.
I like the idea from David Roberts, again, from Volts, that we should make those data centers pay for the extra cost that is leveled to all consumers when they are soaking up too much power and making our power more expensive as a result of that. I know we did a show that touched on a fusion power plant out in the state of Washington that was being built to power an AI center. Mm-hmm. So it was purposeful. They were planning to make their own power. Don't know how many years in the pipeline that'll be,
And certainly AI wants the power today, not later on. So because the thing is moving very rapidly, they're building the models that allow us to do AI, and that's a very energy intensive process. And then using it will continue to use energy.
Right.
But if we could get it's of great value to them. I've inquired of friends and neighbors whether they are on a paid AI program, whether they're using it in their work. And I've hit two people who have paid accounts, and they're paying $20 a month to have the privilege of using the best of current AI. And that's worth a lot of bucks to the people who are developing the centers. So they have deep pockets that they could pay for those costs, and I'd love to see it set up that that if they aren't generating their own power, at least they're offsetting our cost for increases in power costs.
Right, and to the extent that they can generate their own power, I definitely would like to see them channeled toward doing it with renewable energy and batteries. You know, that would be
right. That would be great. Right. And I don't know whether those AI centers have to be close to their audience, as it were, whether they need to be close to where the data is being demanded, or whether it could be at a great distance. But it certainly speaks out for AI centers being located in places that have sun almost every day, the desert areas, or the places where there is wind, like the Texas Panhandle, where T-Bone Pickens, who was
good old T-Bone,
oil magnate, went over and put all this money into wind because he saw it as having better payback.
Right. And yep. And remarkably, Texas is a state with a huge amount of renewable energy, wind and solar. So,
yeah.
I just one more thing on that subject, and we'll probably getting close to the close of this, is that attractive thing about Vermont, or a state that has rivers, a lot of water, if we, of course, think about the nuclear power industry needing to be located where there's lots of water to cool down the units that run that. I think that's where the tripping point could be for a future proposed project in Vermont. So I think folks should just be keeping an eye on that as well.
Right, yeah.
Apparently, the data centers do add things to the water to make the coolant work better in their system, and then what happens to that when the water is dumped? I haven't gotten into the fine print of that one, but that's something to be thinking about and looking at in terms of site pollution. And I'm sure that they're, you know, attempting to do it in a way that doesn't pollute water, but whether it's good enough is the question.
Right.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us here, Linda, and I want to reiterate the bill that we're hoping is going to make crossover, and there's always changes when it goes from one side of the aisle, from the House to the Senate or the other way around. Look up the folks that are on those committees, the Senate Natural Resources Committee, the House Environment and Energy Committees, and get in touch with them and express your support if you think this accurate monitoring of greenhouse gases within the state is a worthy bill. I'll tell you, with the bills that are coming out, $500,000 to get accurate data, which will probably, if properly implemented, will save a whole lot more money than that $500,000 in the long term, plus adding to improved health conditions. And one more thing is, maybe if this goes a little bit further, we could have a competition between the various planning commissions as to which region shows the biggest decrease in greenhouse gases. You up for that one?
Yeah, I think that would be great. Here, and a very quick thing, you were mentioning, like, looking up your own legislator and, mm-hmm. and the committees and stuff like that, and I just want to give a plug. The web page for the Vermont General Assembly is a really good one, and it's as simple. It's legislature.vermont, all spelled out, .gov. But if you just Google Vermont legislature, it'll be your first thing. But it's very easy to use. You can look up bills. You can look up committees and see who's members of it. And you can find contact information for each of the reps or senators. So it's really good to use. So I recommend people explore it.
Excellent.
All right. Well, that is great. And getting involved it certainly is it seems like a fog out there, but if you can focus on some little pieces, it makes a difference. And,
yeah, and a small state like Vermont, it's really easy to do. So.
Yeah. So thank you, and thank you for
Having me on. For
sharing your experiences with the legislature and your hopefulness. And your committee, Norwich Energy Committee, has done marvelous things. One of the first electric charging stations at Danowitz Store, and on and on and on, solar panels.
If I might make one note, we actually now have, so that was a level 2 charging station, and that is still in place at Danowitz, and now there's a level 3 station there, too, and that is due to a local person who is motivated and is a private investor on it, and so anyway, so there's a level 3 fast charging station at Danowitz, too.
Well, I'm going to be I'm going to be driving right by there later today. I wasn't planning to stop there, but I will check it out.
Do check it out. Yeah. It's connected with the charging network is something called ViaLink.
Yep, I'm plugged into ViaLink right now here at the law school.
There you go. Okay.
Law school parking. Their level 2 stations are on the same thing.
Yeah.
Same
company.
Good. Perfect.
All right, Linda.
Good.
Thanks for the intel.
Thank you.
All right. Good to talk to you.
Bye.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So Henry, just real quickly on EV charging, that whoever that generous investor was, they invested about $100,000. That's a rough figure as to what it costs to put a single high-speed charger in. So kudos to that anonymous person down in the Norwich area. Yep.
Those high-speed chargers get cheaper by the dozen. So if you you'll notice that the Tesla ones, they are usually a dozen of them in one place, and where you have the power to be able to do that, that reduces the per unit cost dramatically.
Yeah.
So, but it has to be someplace where they're not all sitting idle. It has to be someplace that has enough traffic so that they're actually being used.
Yeah. So, hey, so Henry,
it's
I'm
to have individual ones pop up. It's onward.
Okay. So I'm just looking at the Environmental Action Network link that you sent to me about Vermont 2024 greenhouse gas emissions and targets that are out there. And of course, these are targets that hopefully will be driven by accurate data. And I do see a decrease. So for instance, transportation greenhouse gases, and I'm not sure, well, it says metric tons there. There's a long acronym, but 3.21 is the number for estimated 24, and the hoped for 2025 goes down to 2.92. In fact, all of the numbers here in these categories, transportation, thermal, agriculture, industrial processes, waste management, electricity, and fossil fuel industry are all hopefully, at least by the measure, going down. The one that is going up a little bit is not surprising, and that is electricity. And that is because we are slowly transitioning off of fossil fuels to more use of electricity. And as you commented early in the show, New England in general, but Vermont in particular, have some of the highest utility costs for electricity in the country.
Yeah. But it's still
marvelously efficient and cost-effective to be driving on electricity rather than driving on gas.
Right.
Even with the extraordinarily low gas figures we have right now, although I understand just before the State of the Union address, the gas prices were turning back upwards. But all right, we'll get into the politics of this.
Yeah.
I'm buying gas here in Burlington. Actually, the station in South Royalton, the gas prices are hovering right around $3 a gallon, $3.15 or something. It's actually pretty cheap gas when you look at it in terms of. But you still save, it's half price to drive on our quote unquote expensive electricity, even if you don't have solar powers making it free for you. So
I've got a little tidbit to move over to wildlife. I mentioned this moose discussion that's going to happen at the Tunbridge Public Library this Sunday at 2 p.m. With a wildlife biologist, Josh Bluen. Here's something else that's coming up on Sunday, particularly if you're down there in the Norwich-Hanover area or you want to go down, and this just came in. Wildlife tracking meetup is happening this Sunday, March 1st, from 10 a.m. to noon at the Mink Brook Community Forest in Hanover, New Hampshire, and it's being put together by the Upper Valley Tracking Club. They will be all getting together at 10 a.m. Mink Brook Community Forest parking lot. That is on Greensboro Road, so that's a road that leads outside of Hanover. And they'll go out tracking for a couple of hours throughout a variety of habitats contained in that special parcel of conserved land. At present, it looks like we'll have some warmer temperatures to work with, might even break 40 degrees. That's nice. So if you want to get out there and check on what the critters have been up to, head on down to Mink Brook.
Yeah. We've been hedging on next week's guest. Have you had any, have we got any movement on, you had something in mind, and I have things in mind.
I thought maybe you had confirmed something, Henry, and it had to do with AI and data centers. I do have a local resident here who has been championing a vote that's coming up, of course, town meeting day coming up this coming Tuesday, about at least sort of as a, it's not binding, but a referendum for the town of Royalton to put a moratorium on any potential data center construction in this town. So I'm pretty sure I can get a guest on that subject, but I'm willing to defer to you if you've got something else, Henry.
Okay. We will see what happens. We'll have a chat offline and figure out which way we're jumping. There's two or three things percolating out there. So.
All right. Well, I've got a great job opportunity. We have a writing show here that there's no money involved in. We just have local writers and journalists join us every Tuesday on WordStream at 10 a.m. That rebroadcast of this week's show will be on Saturday morning at 7. But maybe you are a aspiring journalist and would like to become an environmental reporter with Vermont Digger. They are putting together a job for someone to come on out, and here's a little description about it. They work with the UVM's Community News Service. The environmental professional, writing professional Vermont Digger brings together these two institutions, and they are offering, for those of you looking at, well, how much money can you make? Well, if you're pretty good at it, the base pay range is between $60,000 and $70,000 annually. So go to Vermont Digger. I'm sure they'll give you more information. Once again, this is a job for an environmental reporter and UVM Community News Service mentor. So you'll be working with young college students, and the Herald does publish some stories from those students, as well as maybe becoming one of the most powerful independent media sources in the state of Vermont, VT Digger. All right, Henry, I think we're entering our final minute. We are.
All right.
Last comments.
So keep on your calendars. We've got the Tunbridge Civic Club show.
That's right.
In 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I've been traveling to Tunbridge to do the rehearsals. Fun time.
Yeah, a lot of things happening on March 14th. Thank you very much. And thanks to our underwriters. If I can squeeze them in here, I'm going to try. Sola Fleck, Bale, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Wit and Grit, the Yes We Can.